You're listening to episode 20 of Fear the Boots interview series, in which we talk with Eric Mona of Paizo Publishing. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 1 minute. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
This is Johan.
This is Wayne.
And joining us today, we have two guests. One is the guest for interview, and the other is a guy we're just having join us for this recording as a guest host. I guess we'll start with him first. So joining us from Seattle, we have Willie.
Hello.
Willie was a guy that we met at Gen Con. He's also been very supportive of the show for a while, so we wanted to invite him on to join us for an episode. So Willie, I'm glad to have you aboard.
I'm glad to be here, Dan. Thanks.
And then the person we're actually interviewing is Eric Mona.
Who?
The answer to that question would be the guy we did. What we did we determine it was? Interview six
interview
or
interview? I was not on that interview. Yeah. I have never met nor talked to Eric Mona before in my whole life.
It was you, Luke, and Matt on that interview.
Okay, so it has been 3.5 years, but we have him back, and obviously a lot has changed. Eric, take me back. Where was Pathfinder 3.5 years ago?
Boy, you know, Pathfinder 3.5 years ago was probably had just come out or was about to come out, depending on exactly when the interview was done. So, boy, a lot has changed.
Yeah, so the creation and the really cementing of the product. You have, of course, the creation of the Pathfinder Society. You don't have to divulge anything you don't want to, but people in the know in the industry have said that you guys are now outselling D&D. And I'm curious how that feels.
Oh, that feels pretty good. I mean, I think what most people are talking about when they say that is there's a trade publication called ICV2 that posts a quarterly top 10 RPG sales. And we actually did outpace Wizards of the Coast D&D in the last time they released that. Exactly how true that is really kind of depends on your point of view. I mean, the ICV2 interviews hobby distributors and hobby retailers. So that's like your local game store. So I think basically from my perspective, the anecdotal reports that we've gotten is that I think that's probably true. I think at this point in time, Pathfinder probably is outselling D&D in the hobby stores. But then again, you've got the DDI, their online initiative, which is not tracked by that. You've got bookstore sales, which is not tracked by that. You've got our own subscriptions, which are not tracked by that. So it's kind of like we, in this industry, we go by the least crappy evidence that we have. and in this case, in that one specific sales channel, which is hobby game stores, we are apparently outselling D&D. And that, even though I've spent the last minute undercutting that, that's a pretty big deal. That has not really ever happened. It happened, I guess, for a month or maybe a quarter with White Wolf's Vampire back when the second edition was kind of in its dying days. But since then, from my understanding, is that those anecdotal reports that the various trade magazines have done, D&D has actually never been unthroned since that brief White Wolf period.
I thought going way back, there was also a brief period where BattleTech was over D&D.
Or maybe that's just what you wanted to believe.
Boy, I don't know. I have no idea.
That's the way I remember history.
That's right.
All right, so Eric, let's start this at the start. For anyone who has not been with our show since the April 2008 interview or is not really familiar with you, you want to give a quick resume of who you are and where you've been, what you've done, who you've killed, and where the bodies are buried, and what you'll pay me not to release this.
Fair enough. Well, I'm Eric Bona. I am the publisher at Paizo Publishing. I've been with the company since the first day that it started almost 10 years ago. We'll celebrate our 10th anniversary this upcoming July. Prior to that, I was an editor of D&D magazines over at Wizards of the Coast. I joined Wizards in 1999. Didn't really participate too much, but I was there during the creation of third edition and the playtesting part of that, and got to be sort of at Wizards when they launched that. Then I was the publications coordinator for the RPGA, the Role Playing Game Association. I also co-founded the Living Greyhawk campaign while at Wizards of the Coast and launched Living Greyhawk Journal magazine to support that. Was also editing Polyhedron. Eventually, Polyhedron got combined to Dungeon magazine, and I was transferred to the periodicals department. And that department as a whole was spun off from Wizards of the Coast and actually became Paizo Publishing. Actually was editor of Dungeon for a time after that. I launched the Age of Worms Adventure Path, concluded the Shackle City Adventure Path, and then moved on to be editor-in-chief of Dragon and Dungeon at the same time. I was promoted to be publisher at Paizo. At that point, I was also editor-in-chief of Dragon. Got to go through the entire run from that point till the last print issue of Dragon 359, which was the final print one after Wizards decided that it would be better to take their magazines online to their D&D Online initiative, or I guess I should say D&D Insider. At that point, we had real crisis of conscience here at Paizo and had to decide what we were going to do, and we decided to create a monthly Adventure Path product called Pathfinder that would support the 3.5 edition of D&D. And then a couple of years later, D&D decided to do 4th edition under a very different licensing sort of structure that was not an open license like 3.5 had been. So we looked at our options again and said, well, what are we going to do? At that time, some of the initial stuff for 4th edition was starting to kind of come out, and our audience primarily, or predominantly, I should say, was sort of begging us not to support 4th edition. As more and more information came to light about the licensing scheme for 4th edition, it all sort of became irrelevant because we were unwilling to work under that. And so we decided to do the Pathfinder role-playing game. And that's probably about where we were in April of 2008. We'd put out a beta playtest version, and we got 55,000 people to download that.
Wow.
And then that became the final Pathfinder role-playing game, which came out that next Gen Con. And then since then, we blazed through 5 print runs of the Pathfinder role-playing game. We've now got Pathfinder campaign setting products. Pathfinder Adventure Path continues strong and is on issue number like 52 right now. We've got Pathfinder Tales novels. We have 2 different lines of Pathfinder miniatures. Pathfinder, Pathfinder, Pathfinder. It's kind of exploding.
So I'm kind of curious from
Pathfinder.
I'm kind of curious from day to day. What does a publisher do?
Lots of
publishes, Wayne. Publishes.
Yeah, come
my
on.
My case changed pretty drastically. For today, as an example, I came in and approved some images for our licensed Pathfinder Battles miniatures that we're doing with WizKids. I worked with our graphic design team to get all of the bottom of the miniature text, figured out how we were going to do that for that set. I sat in a meeting with my cohorts of the management team, which is Jeff Alvarez, who handles our operations. Lisa Stevens, who is the owner of the company, is the CEO, and then her partner, Vic Wirtz, who handles the tech side and is in charge of the website. We spent about 3 hours talking about strategy and different licensing stuff and just kind of our weekly meeting. And then I came down from there. I proofread all the bottom of the text for the Pathfinder battle set. And now I'm doing an interview with you guys. But basically, I managed editorial department. I handle almost all of the marketing for the position. I manage the sales department of the company. I'm basically the business guy. If it's a movie, I am probably the producer, but I'm a producer who used to be a director, so I kind of understand all the different elements that go in, and I manage the creative staff as well.
You've shattered my image, because when you first said you were a publisher, I just mm-hmm. pictured you pushing movable type into a wooden block, and then that's the image I'm keeping. That's what you did today. Movable type.
Yeah.
Hard work. Seems like a crappy way to print things with MS Word, but
then I came to record this interview on the phonograph and
that's right.
Be broadcast by teletype.
So you kind of have to have your hand in everything in order to be able to do your job well, kind of, huh?
Yeah.
Sort of be aware of everything that's going on.
Exactly. I mean, there are days where I have to be very hands-on and go from sort of desk to desk and help people out with specific tasks. And then there are days where I'm trapped in meetings the entire day and don't see my staff at all. So it sort of depends. And luckily, I've got good people.
Yeah, I remember because when I went down to DigiPen, the dean came down and talked to us. And he was talking about what it meant to be a game designer, which is, you know, what the school is kind of known for. But it kind of sounds similar to your job in that you have to be able to coordinate everything sort of together, maybe not from like a design standpoint, but more from a business standpoint.
Yeah.
And one of the other things is that it all kind of rests on your shoulders for a little business standpoint.
I think that there's a lot of truth in that. I mean, we as a management team work very closely together, and we've got a very collaborative process. But I mean, when it comes to what products we do, when we do them, how they get made, that's all under my responsibility.
You talked about how prior to Pathfinder, you had quite a bit of experience with the RPGA, Living Greyhawk, social game organization sort of things. And I'm curious, what did you learn from those that figured into how the Pathfinder Society was set up?
Well, wow. I learned a lot of things. I mean, I think, going back from the very beginning, when I started with RPGA actually playing in the events, now for a long time I was a member just to get the free Polyhedron subscription, but once I actually started playing, I learned that, you know, you can have fun with just about any kind of organized play environment, but at the time, Living City was the big network initiative. It was the very first campaign where you kind of made your own character, and you'd play that character at a variety of adventures that were tiered, you know, so that if a first level group did it, they might be fighting a goblin, but if like a fifth level group did it, they might be fighting an ogre, like that kind of a thing. The story would be the same. That type of event where you got to play a character of your choice as opposed to a character that was provided to you, which had been sort of the traditional tournament structure, that was much more compelling, and people really, really liked that. There's something about role-playing games that when it is a character that you have created from your own imagination, it's just that much stronger and you're that much more interested in it. So we were able to see as a something that we tracked sort of the opinions of the members of the RPGA, and over the period from about mid-90s to third edition, the classics, which was what they call the ones where you would get the characters provided, the popularity of those really started to wane, and the popularity of this living campaigns, Living City being the biggest one, really started to grow. And so when Lisa Stevens actually came up with the idea to do Living Greyhawk as manager of the whole RPGA network, they knew they wanted to have a campaign where you created your own character. One of the things they also wanted to do was take advantage of people's eagerness to contribute by breaking up the real world into about 30 different regions. And each one of those regions had a country from the world of Greyhawk. So for instance, if you were from the Pacific Northwest, you got the Duchy of Ernst. That was your country. And if you were from Minneapolis, where I had been prior to moving there, you got the Shield Lands. And Wisconsin got Highfolk or what have you. So we named three regional triad members, is what we called them, and they were volunteers. And those guys kind of ran the campaign locally. So local players would feel as though they had some interaction with the campaign management. And we also had it so that local players could write scenarios set in their kingdom, and you had to go to that real world location to be able to play in those adventures, which I think worked really, really well on one hand, because people really had a lot of sort of connection to the plot lines and to their own countries. But on the other hand, I guess in terms of lessons learned, I think that was extraordinary waste of effort, because you had a lot of people designing adventures that only ever got played by, you know, a couple of hundred people tops. Yeah. And so one of the things that we did with the Pathfinder Society was I knew, like, basically the same day that we decided we needed to do the Pathfinder role-playing game, I knew we needed to do an organized play campaign to support it. And that's what became Pathfinder Society. And in fact, the whole idea of the name Pathfinder and the idea of the Pathfinder Society being sort of an adventurer's guild, all that was built from the very beginning to be kind of a natural framework to deliver adventure hooks for the Organized Play Society. We got the name Pathfinder for the Adventure Path product because we'd been doing adventure paths, and that just seemed like the natural name. Pathfinder makes sense. Mm-hmm. But once we decided we needed to do a Pathfinder role-playing game, I suspected that we might have to do that from the very beginning. And so Pathfinder Society from day one, you'll see one of the first articles. In fact, the article that I wrote in Pathfinder Adventure Path number one introduces the Pathfinder Society as an in-world organization. And that had always been intended to be a sort of a framing device for our own organized play campaign. And indeed, the first year that we did the organized play campaign, it was actually for the 3.5 rules. So we actually transitioned after season zero, sort of our playtest season, into the Pathfinder role-playing game rules with an organized play campaign that had already been around for 1 year at that point in time. So we were able to start Pathfinder RPG with an organized play campaign a whole lot of people really already cared about, which I think helped a lot.
Everything I've heard about Living Greyhawk sounds very intriguing. I mean, one of our other hosts, Chris, did it for years. It sounds very story-driven. Everyone had strongly developed characters, and it was very well thought out. My experience with Pathfinder Society, though, I haven't seen as much of that. I see a very deep story. It's more of the flavor around it. The actual Pathfinder Society games I've seen, and it may just be the people that were running them, it always seems to be much more of a simple dungeon crawl. Nobody's acting in character. There's no personalities. There is story there, but it's all implied.
Honestly, I think it has a lot to do with who you're seated with. I mean, I over the course of Living City, I played over 400 games, either as a GM or as a player. And it ranged from just the most excruciating, you know, and this was before smartphones, so you were basically just stranded at the table. There was no... and I have seen people fake emergencies to leave RPG.
I have to go. I am having a heart attack right now.
The same convention, you could run into great in-depth role players with awesome senses of character. I remember the first convention I ever played RPGA at, the first couple of games that I'd signed up for, I was beside myself. I was so frustrated because, you know, exactly what you had said, you know, the players were not engaged. They were just kind of lumps. I couldn't tell one character from the other. And I was about to give up on it, you know, but I'd already paid for the convention. And so I went to the second day. And then in that second day, I sat down with guys who were way superior to even the home group that I'd been playing with for years. And those guys ended up becoming some of my best friends, you know. That's pretty cool. So I think it has a lot to do with who you're seated with, who's the GM. But I also wonder when was the last time you played a Pathfinder Society event?
A few months ago.
Oh, okay. Because some of the earlier scenarios, I think, were maybe a little more dungeon crawly, and there have been more story elements, continuing stories and things in the last couple of years.
Do you remember the name of the module?
Not offhand.
It's called Dungeon Crawly McDungerson.
No, there is a lot of story to it, though.
I mean, crawl.
It's very obvious when you read through, you know, getting all set up in Pathfinder Society, it's tailored towards more roleplay in the way it describes things. And the setting is very, you know, well described, and there's a lot of things going on in the scenario. Everyone at the table was from a different faction.
It sounds like the production value was there for the roleplaying.
Yeah.
It's just that there was a choice not to role play.
And it may be partially because there's a time limitation as well. I mean, you've got to get through the entire contents within the base of the time you're at.
You don't have time to see how you feel.
The number one lesson that I would take away from my time, not just in the RPGA, but Pathfinder Society and organized play in general, I've traveled all over the country. And in fact, you know, I've gone to England and Finland and other places in the world. And the big takeaway for me is that people get different things out of the game. Some people are really into the role playing and really into the, you know, they might, for example, you might get a mission where it starts in a tavern or something, and they might spend the entire 4-hour period of time just like role playing with the tavern wench and the bartender and never even go on the mission, right? Whereas other people are just very tactically oriented. They kind of think you're wasting time if you're talking in voice or something. And sometimes the beauty of an organized play thing at a convention like Gen Con, or even better, at a local convention, is you can kind of sample a bunch of different players, and you can kind of see who's more in tune with your own tastes, and then you can recruit those people into your home games or just play with those people more regularly. And so I guess the biggest takeaway for me is that there is a huge variety of tastes in what people come to, whether it's D&D or Pathfinder or another game, what they get out of it. Sometimes I can't even tell. You know, you could get the guy who never talks in character and he never says really anything, and you say, you know, how did you have fun? And he's like, yeah, that was the greatest. You know, and you never saw him smile the entire time. Whereas you kind of have other people who are just like totally effusive and they are really into the role play. And then you say, wow, you must have really had a blast. And they say, no, I didn't really. That scenario I didn't really care for. So it's dangerous, I think. And I think this is a challenge for a lot of game companies. You cannot assume that the way that you and your buddies have played for your whole career is the same way that everybody plays. And I think in some ways going to these organized play things and seeing the variety of play styles is one of the most eye-opening things that you can do, because you really can understand that some people love the out-of-the-dungeon stuff. You can really understand that some people love the shopping and the maximization of their character, the min-maxing. Some people don't care about that at all. And I don't think, until you've played with a large number of players, I think it's really easy to assume that every group is just like your group. And I'm not arguing that it's a great thing to go to a convention and play with, you know, five guys for 4 hours that never get into character and that you know, you just want to pull your eyes out, you know, before the thing is over. I'm not saying that's great. I am saying that there's a huge variety of tastes and play styles, and organized play is one way that you can get to experience a bunch of them, both the bad and the really good. So I would say don't give up.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
What about the other end of it, of organized play? What is the company, what is the business get out of organized play? Do you guys see it as just a way to, this is promotion, it gets people involved, it gets people playing the games, or do you get some other added value out of running it? Because I mean, this can't be cheap or easy to run. I mean, you guys, I would imagine you guys expend a pretty decent amount of resources to get this going.
It's not cheap, and it is definitely not easy to run, especially as it grows bigger and bigger, and you know, people say, well, I've played all the scenarios, I need more, and you're like, well, we're killing ourselves to give you what we're giving already, you know. And so yeah, it's not easy, but I think the easy answer is, yeah, it's like marketing, you know, and it helps sell books. You know, all the books that we publish that have rules in them are campaign legal. Sometimes we have to say, you know, this one spell, which is designed to work in a home game, needs to be changed a little bit in this organized play environment where you have a different GM every time you play. But that's part of it. That's the very basic part. You know, yeah, okay, so if you're really into Pathfinder Society, you're probably going to want to keep abreast of the latest rules developments and buy the books. But I think a much more important part of it, I mean, look, you can get our rules for free on the internet by going to paizo.com/PRD. We're giving away the rules. So it's not just about selling rule books. Part of it, for me, is about the network of players. You know, one of the reasons why Dungeons & Dragons has been the king forever is that if you want to play a D&D game, chances are your friends who are gamers know how to play. They might rather play Talislanta or Hall Cthulhu or something like that, but it's not hard to get together a group of D&D players. It is harder to get together a group of players for a different kind of game. And so if it's tough for you to, let's say you want to play Pathfinder, but your friends are all into 4th edition or they just don't like fantasy or something like that, knowing that there's a Pathfinder Society game going on at your local convention or at your local game store is a way for you to hook into other people who have similar interests to you. And so I think part of it is to just keep that community of Pathfinder players healthy and engaged, whether they're buying our products or not. And if you can find a game with those guys, and even if none of them are buying the books, if you're still buying the books because you've got a Pathfinder collection, you know, you may have stopped if you can't find anybody to play the game with. And as long as there is a robust, organized play program in place that is easy to access and easy to see and easy to find, you're always going to be able to play Pathfinder. And I think that, to me, is a slightly more important version of it, because it's cool to buy all the books. You know, we all know, or perhaps sometimes we've even been that guy who just buys the books. You know, he doesn't have an active campaign. He likes to think about, you know, imagining what the maybe the world of Galarian or the Forgotten Realms or something, what that might be like. And he likes keeping abreast of the continuity in the same way that you might for a comic book. But yeah, if you're not actually playing the game, it's a lot easier for you to stop participating and stop buying the products. But as long as you've got that connection to the game and you're building fun memories and you know, having a good time with it, I have to think that your interest level in the game and, in by extension, the products that Paizo publishes is much more difficult to erode.
So I had a question for you, Eric. It's maybe a little non sequitur, but I was reading an article a while ago, or it was an interview that you did on Wizards' website. In one of the questions, it was talking about how you first got into Dragon Magazine, and you said something about how you first got into Dungeons & Dragons and had something to do with a after-school activity class thing, something run through your elementary school, and you had to, like, your mom had to talk to the principal to let you in because it was only for the more mature 4th to 6th graders.
So that's exactly right. I was in 3rd grade, and I had to petition the school specifically to join a class for the upperclassmen, you know, the 4th through 6th graders. It was in 1983, I think. So we're talking about the high point of D&D as kind of a cultural phenomenon. Around that year is when Dragon posted its highest subscription numbers, its highest circulation numbers. That's when the D&D cartoon kind of started around 1983. And so D&D was really ubiquitous. It was pretty much everywhere. I knew I was interested in it because I really like Greek mythology and monsters and dinosaurs and stuff like that. And so when my older cousin kind of got into, I remember seeing him play Village of Hamlet one afternoon over at his house, and that cover image, I think more than anything else, kind of struck me. There's a party of adventurers, and there are these nasty looking ghouls kind of coming out from behind these pillars, and I'm like, that is what I want to do. That is really cool. And my older cousin and his friends were having a lot of fun, and so when I saw that they were doing a class, I already had some of the books. I didn't have the first clue what to do with them. You know, I mean, I was in 2nd or 3rd grade at the time, and so I was mostly just kind of fumbling my way through this stuff. And so when I heard that there was a high school kid who was putting on a class in the school library, I did everything I could, including, you know, getting my parents to harangue the principal in order to get to go to that.
All right,
thing.
Now, hang on. This is something I'm having trouble wrapping my brain around.
Yeah, me too. I know, right?
Your mom had to go in to convince somebody to let you play D&D in the 1980s. In the early 80s, your parents were fighting to get you to play D&D.
Hell yeah, man. What else should they be doing? Like burning my books and chanting to the Lord or something? I don't know.
Something like that.
Yeah, not my family, man. So they were really supportive. supportive, actually. I think, you know, there was a lot of hysteria.
You say that so casually. Is it like a Hail Satan family or what?
No, not really. I mean, I think at the time, anyway. My dad has always had a radio show on Sunday mornings in Minneapolis. And so because of that, he has never been particularly religious, or at least not getting us to go to church. The religion thing really didn't play into it. I think my mom probably saw some of the same like Donahue shows that all the other parents did in the 80s. And she was a little concerned. And then I think she saw us play, you know, and she's like, wait, this is just a bunch of kids like doing math and making stuff up. My parents have never, you know, I think they had high expectations of my brother and me, but they never really kind of like shied away from like, ooh, you know, there's a scary movie. We can't have Eric look at the scary monster. You know, they knew I was into that stuff, whether they wanted me to be or not. And so they were really supportive. And I really, really appreciate that. Obviously, it's had pretty significant impacts on just the trajectory of my life. So my folks were always really, really supportive, including, yeah, you know, basically going to the principal and saying, hey, you know, let my kid play D&D.
I'm just astounded. I've never heard of D&D being a registered extracurricular class. Activity. Like, yeah, like it's like it's on your resume.
You know, it was like something special about 1983. It was the summer of D&D. I don't know what it was. I don't think my memory is that it didn't last. Like, I don't remember being in D&D class, you know, in like fourth, fifth, or sixth grade. I'd love to find this guy because I owe him a significant debt of gratitude. I can't even remember the guy's name, but I think it was just a local gamer who kind of went to the school and said, here's this game that a lot of kids are playing. It's kind of a phenomenon. It'd kind of be like having a, you know, like a Pokemon League or something at a school, which I think is not quite as rare these days, or at least maybe rare now, but wasn't rare 5 years ago. And so yeah, we had it. There was probably about maybe 20 kids in it. And so the first session that I did was Palace of the Silver Princess, and I was a player in there, and we had, you know, 20 some kids adventuring through that adventure at one time, which was brutal.
So 20 kids in a D&D club. I'm going to try and work this out. One word for Paizo, 9 are in jail, 10 are dead in the sewers.
the steam tunnels for sure. It'd be interesting to find out. You know, I know some of those guys still, and they, you know, they.
You still write to them on the inside?
They're on my Facebook anyway, but I don't know if any of them, you know, still play D&D, but I bet a bunch of them play Warcraft. They're still big nerds. But you know what's funny, actually, is my memories tell me that not all the kids in that class were what you would sort of traditionally call a nerd. You know, I say that nicely, like I definitely am one of those, right?
Don't say nerd nicely. Say it like in Revenge of the Nerds. Go,
nerd. They weren't necessarily the kids who were like the advanced readers and the, you know, the kids who loved doing math and stuff. It was a wide cross section. There was a weird period in the 80s, at least where I grew up, where D&D was not a hugely stigmatized thing, that most kids, I think, at least kind of knew what it was. And many of them had checked it out. People you would not, you know, normally look at and go, oh, that guy's a gamer. It was pretty widespread. Which meant, you know, there were kids playing it on recess. And I mean, we had a ton of fun with D&D in grade school.
Do you think it's that maybe it just hadn't been around long enough to have accumulated stigma?
Maybe. I think part of it probably was that people's parents told them that they couldn't do it, and that made it more attractive.
Right.
For some.
Just like, you know, rock and roll and everything else.
Yeah. I think there's an element to that. I'm not really sure what it was. I think computer games kind of sucked at the time, to be perfectly honest. So I think I know I'm like saying something completely outrageous here, but you know, it's like ColecoVision is not the same thing as Xbox 360 or
one of your colleagues.
Yes.
Mike Stackpole contributed as one of the six writers to one of the greatest games of all time, Wasteland,
that was good.
Yeah, and that came out right around that time.
That's fair. But you know what? I do think
you're
now,
talking trash on Bard's Tale and the Gold Box games. And
how many kids do you remember who were not sort of traditionally what you would call gamers, who were into stuff like Wizardry and Ultima One and Phantasy Star and all that? I don't remember that. I remember that being kind of on the nerdier cusp. And in some ways, and I'm trying to remember something from 1983, so I could be wrong, but my memory tells me that D&D as a social activity was less stigmatized in some ways even than computer games back then.
And Wasteland didn't come out until 88. I stand by 83.
Wasteland.
I don't think much good
was
out
over
yet.
By the time Wasteland came
out. If we were talking like after 85, then I'd be willing to back your
Ultima
argument.
Was out,
not 83.
Because Ultima Zero or Ashkelon was like late 70s. So I know that was around.
We're talking pretty crap Zork. Yeah.
You know, actually, like, guys, I really have to side with Eric on this one.
Thank you.
I'm not a huge fan of old games. I mean, yeah, when I played them when I was a kid, oh, greatest thing ever. Original Pac-Man, Pac-Man on the Atari, that whack, 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 whack. That was fun at that time.
I don't think we even had Oregon Trail at 83 yet.
I really have a hard time going back. Oh, yeah, remember your roots.
Well, we're not talking about going back. We're talking about how good they were then.
Well, they were the
only
thing.
When all those games came out,
then,
like Bard's Tale and even Wasteland, I remember Wasteland being described to me as it's like Gamma World, but on a computer. All that stuff was borrowing pretty heavily from D&D back then.
And now Fallout's like Wasteland, except on the Xbox.
Right, and I got to tell you, I mean, just to I don't know if I undermine my argument here at all, but yesterday was Columbus Day, and Paizo had the day off because we have all the postal holidays off, and I spent the whole day playing Fallout.
Nice. Fallout 1?
1, 2, 3, New Vegas.
New Vegas, New the Vegas. Dead Money expansion.
Oh, I just beat the final one, the final expansion. What was it called? The Lonesome Trail or something to that?
Yes.
I can't think what it's called, but the final one, I just beat it. And I got to say, I thought the expansions for this one were better than Fallout 3, but I know I'm going to catch some flack for
that. I'm still playing through New Vegas now myself.
Let me go back to something here more Pathfinder related. Pathfinder has been around in one form or another for about 3.5 years. And one of the things that I think gave you guys instant success, I mean, in addition to the quality of the product, was the fact that D&D was moving from 3.0 and 3.5 into 4th edition. And through the OGL, you guys were able to keep doing that in perfect continuity and already having access to much of D&D's audience through things like, you know, Dungeon and Dragon and whatnot. You were perfectly positioned to capture that audience and to keep supporting that product. And, you know, a lot of people, of course, as I'm sure you're well aware, colloquially call Pathfinder 3.75.
Yeah.
And right. My question for you is this. Now it's been 3.5 years. Yep. And if we look at the typical turnover on editions within the next year to 2 years to 3 years, is there a chance of a 3.8 or a Pathfinder 2?
Or actually, my question is, do you guys get incensed by being called 3.75? Okay, well, do you want to carve your own niche?
We'll take that in order then. Let's start with the 3.75 thing. Okay. How do you feel about being identified that way?
I don't mind at all. In fact, I think I may have coined that originally when we were sort of saying, we don't know what we're going to do next, and sort of laying out, you know, if things don't proceed the way that we hope they do, which was that the 4th edition licensing scheme would be awesome and that indeed 4th edition itself would be awesome, you know, we might have to do this. And I think that might be where it originally came from. So it doesn't bother me at all. If people want to call it 3.75, that's fine. It's not a terrible description. It does suggest that it is a midpoint between 3.5 and 4th edition. And that in and of itself, I think, is a little bit incorrect because, you know, we're not building toward any particular end goal. We're just trying to make the game incrementally better.
All right. But if nothing else, 3.75 is shorter than 3.5 without the shitty grapple rules.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
I thought
right.
The grapple rules were still there.
No,
they've changed their own grapple rules.
We did our best.
I'm actually kind of happy with what they've done with
that
grapple.
That makes it less shitty, of course, is for you to decide, but we're pretty happy with it. So yeah, so that doesn't bother me at all. People can call it whatever they want. In terms of a new edition, you know, you said a couple of different things that are kind of interesting, you know, a 3.8 or a full new edition. You know, it's interesting to wonder if there's a difference between those two things. We have not started work on a new edition. We don't have any plans to do one. Right now, Pathfinder Core Rulebook sold more copies in 2010 than it did in 2009. So until we see significant slowing down of the Core Rulebook sales, or again, if we hear from the audience and the audience starts saying, you know, this thing is feeling like it could use a tune-up, then for sure we'll consider that. You know, I mean, we have done very well by listening to our audience and giving them what they tell us they want. I mean, I have a business philosophy that goes back very, very long, you know, even to the Dragon and Dungeon years, which is if you give people what they tell you they want, they will trade you money for it. And that is definitely the philosophy that kind of guides the company. If we start feeling that Pathfinder fans are getting tired of Pathfinder or want us to do something new, then I think we'd more seriously look at it. Right now, we're much more focused on stuff like, okay, so we know that the 600-page core rulebook is a pretty daunting way to get into the hobby for someone who's not familiar with role-playing. Maybe we ought to create something simpler. And that's where, like, the Pathfinder Beginner Box that's coming out at the end of this month, that's where that comes from. So I think that different presentations of some of the material, that might be one way we could go. You know, really, we're continuing to do two adventure paths a year Those are very, very popular for us. We've got a whole world. We just opened up a whole other continent on our world. We got plenty to do. We're in no hurry to start a new edition.
What I'm kind of curious about is basically when you guys realized that 4.0 wasn't going to be OGL, that you weren't going to be able to continue down that path, was there a conversation at that point of, do we build something from the ground up and keep going down the path we are, versus do we take the OGL and create something new based on
that? We didn't really consider doing something brand new. You know, we'd been using the 3.5 or 3.0 system for 10 years pretty much at that point, and we were very comfortable with it. We liked the game system. You know, we knew there were some areas, like for instance the grapple rules, that needed some working on it, and that's why we put out an alpha and a beta with kind of some of our thoughts about how we might change things around, and then we incorporated the input of all the play testers and got it to be, I think, a much better game than it would have been if we had just kind of set it out on our own. So no, that was never really an option. You know, we'd been publishing Pathfinder Adventure Path for over a year under the OGL. The OGL is irrevocable. We like third edition. You know, it was never really on the table that we would create something wholly new. You know, I think now if we were to create like another science fiction role-playing game or something like that, and we were to do it totally from the ground up and completely original, I think Paizo has got enough cachet as an RPG publisher at this point that people would say, oh, let's check that out. But I'm not 100% sure that was true 3.5-4 years ago. I think 3.5-4 years ago, people knew Paizo as a company that was a really good source for compelling third edition content. And it's quite a different deal to start from, you know, with as edition zero as it is to go from 3.5 to 3.75, if you will.
Let's talk about this beginner box set. I wonder if you could tell us real quickly what it is, and then I have several questions about it.
All right. Well, the beginner box is our attempt to create an entry-level product for the Pathfinder RPG, and in fact, for tabletop role-playing games in general. So it's a $34.99 box. The box contains...
99 cents too much. I'm sorry.
Will it be red?
I'm sorry to hear that. Are you sure it's not 100 cents too much? So we could have made it $33.99 and then you'd have what you'd want.
Ooh, you know, yeah, you can tell you're a businessman. I like that deal and dealing.
And it'll look cheaper. So yes, anyway, yes. So what we did is we put together this box. It's got a 64-page Heroes Handbook, which is kind of a player's guide. It's got a 96-page GM's guide. It's got 4 character classes. You can go up to 5th level. It's got a made-up adventure in there that kind of teaches you the game incrementally. We did some playtesting with some sort of random, not gamers, but people who are kind of interested in fantasy and stuff, like 15-year-olds.
How
and
do you
20
recruit
olds?
People like that?
They're market research firms that have questionnaires and that they, you know, they have big lists of, you know, let's say 15-year-olds. And so they'll just cold call all those people and they'll say, are you interested in fantasy and science fiction? If they say no, then they hang up on them basically.
That's what I do. That's what I do every time I get on the phone.
I'm up to F in the phone book.
Yeah. Hi, Mom. Are you into fantasy sci-fi?
Or something.
Click.
And a lot of times they'll ask like kind of questions like, are you a Democrat? Are you a Republican? And if you say no, and they were a Republican firm that's wanting to ask Republicans how they feel about a particular policy, and you say, no, I'm a Democrat or whatever, then they'll say, oh, that's all the questions I have for you. You know, they're kind of just funneling people.
Yeah, because they got so many people to work through.
You know, there are companies that run these, and we contracted with a company that does these. And it's great because they actually have like a full-on facility with the one-way mirror and the rooms, and you can sort of watch unobtrusively as people fumble their way through your role-playing game, and you can write with horror, oh my god, you know, we didn't describe initiative well enough or what have you. So we did a number of tests with that.
And
with
the nerds.
With the pre-generated characters that come with the box, and I'll talk about those in a minute, the hand-holdy adventure that is actually the first chapter of the GM's guide, you can actually open the box and be playing Pathfinder within about 15 minutes of opening the box. So that was really important to us. So so there's the GM book, there's the player book, there is a flip mat, a double-sided flip mat, which is kind of a laminated mat, and one side has got the dungeon from the adventure in the box set, and then the other side's actually blank, so you can use it to create your own adventures. And much of the GM's book is about creating your own adventures as well. So we're not just teaching people how to make a character or how to play once. We're teaching people how to kind of play an entire Pathfinder campaign. And so let's see what else. There's about 100 counters, sort of three-dimensional counters with plastic stands, cardboard. There's a set of dice blank character sheet so you can create your own characters. And really what we wanted to do is create a product that whether you were an experienced gamer who wanted to use it to teach people, whether you were a new gamer just trying to explore it on your own, there's a solo adventure, or whether you're like a group of new players who just want to open the box and start playing, you know, there are multiple entry points into this box set for you. So the Pathfinder role-playing game beginner box is meant to be an introduction to the Pathfinder role-playing game. We've slimmed down some of the rules. We've removed a lot of the choices so you don't kind of have that option paralysis of knowing which of 15, you know, barbarian rage powers you would want to pick, for example. In fact, we don't even let you pick a barbarian. So there's the fighter, the rogue, the cleric, and the wizard. There are humans, elves, and dwarves. But there's no gnomes and halflings because we didn't want to get into difference that size categories have in the game.
And we don't have the stupid races.
We don't want things like attacks of opportunity or difficult combat maneuvers and stuff. So really what it is it's still the same basic Pathfinder game, but it's introduced in a way that you're not sort of crippled by a bunch of stuff you don't need to know just to start playing.
Well, and let me ask you now two questions on this. The first question is, your slimmed down rules is still roughly 160 pages, but you said you can be playing within about 15 minutes. Help me connect A and B here.
Well, because the character sheets, the pre-generated character sheets that we've included in there are actually 4 pages. So if you imagine an 11 by 17 sheet of paper printed on both sides and then folded in half to make almost like a little booklet, the first page of it has a picture of the character. And so it might say Valeros, who's our fighter character. And it will say fighter, you know, and then it'll say play a fighter if you want to do a bunch of damage, be awesome at using weapons and armor, really basic stuff. So if you don't even know what a fighter is, it tells you that. And then on the back, it's got another picture of the character in action and then some background and personality stuff to give you some idea of who Valeros is. So then you open this booklet and the character, sort of a traditional one sheet character sheet, is in the middle of this thing. And then on both sides, there are callouts that tell you what every single part of the character sheet means, you know, how to make an attack roll. There's a list of all the different things you can do in a round. There's a list of what your spells are and how they work, depending on what your character, because if you're a rogue, or there's a little chart that explains flanking and how you can do more damage if you get yourself into a flanking position. And so really all the stuff that you need to play is right there on your character sheet. Sure, if you want to like figure out what some magic item that you don't have, what that does, you need to open the book. But you can play that first adventure pretty much with just the character sheet in front of you.
That is an incredible idea. I mean, I wish every starter box set had cheat sheets. At very least, a little laminated sheet that you can pass out to every one of your players.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's been really fun about putting together the beginner box is usually how these products work is our game designers kind of sit down and they write a whole bunch of text, and then they work with the art directors and they say, okay, and we're going to need a picture of an ogre killing a gnome or whatever. Killing an ogre. What? But then they work together to kind of describe what that picture looks like. And then when the editing is done, they send the text over to the art director. The art director dumps it into, you know, an InDesign file. And then from there, some magic jiggery pokery, and all of a sudden it looks like a book. And then the editors do one final proof pass, and it's done. How this project worked, because our senior graphic designer, Sarah Robinson, who's responsible for a lot of the look of Pathfinder products in general, her background is in, you know, video game strategy guides. She worked at Nintendo Power Magazine a while ago. And so she's very visual in how she thinks about stuff. And so the designers would say, okay, here's kind of what we're trying to do. And she would then say, no, you know, do it this. There's too many words. Or it's you know, you got to come up with a more visual way of presenting this information. And that synthesis between the art side and the design side, I think really kind of put together this project in a way that would have been impossible if it had just been a bunch of word people saying, okay, and then we need to explain this, and then we need to explain this. So because of that, we really are thinking much more visually than Pathfinder fans, at least, are used to seeing in our products. So, you know, there's a lot of like color, there's a lot of little boxes with information in it, there's a lot of really kind of hand-holdy, okay, here's how an attack roll works, you know, on the character sheet itself. And I'm really impressed with how that's come out. But it would not have been possible if it had not been such a collaborative process.
So here's my second question. Throughout the 80s and early to mid 90s, many, many games had box sets, starter boxes or supplement boxes or whatever. But the prevailing wisdom for the past 10, 15 years has been, do not do a box set. Box sets are bad ideas. It's hard to shelve them. It's hard to sell them. But now we have WotC coming around and making box sets. You guys are starting with a box set. What changed?
I think a few things have changed. I mean, I think part of it, I can't really speak for Wizards of the Coast, but I'll attempt to for just a second. I think what they did with their red box is very nostalgic in presentation. So if you look at the way that it looks, and they use an old Larry Elmore painting on the cover of it, I think that was all about gamers who are now in their 30s buying a game that they could share with their kids and making it comfortable. And so the red box sold over a million copies. It's probably the most successful D&D product ever created. I think they're hearkening back to that with the presentation of the red box. And so nostalgia has some element to do with it. I think another thing is, I think that some of that prevailing wisdom about don't do box sets, they won't sell, I think that was not necessarily that accurate. I think part of it was developed out of TSR, and I think TSR had some really bad controls in place in terms of cost, and the design team would decide what would go in the box, and then my understanding is the production team or whatever would figure out how much it costs, but there was not enough back and forth. They actually were publishing products at the end of TSR that cost them money every time they sold one. So I think that played into it. If you look at some of the latter day box sets, they had a lot of crap in them, then some of that crap was very, very expensive. And then I think the market has changed a lot. I think that Amazon plays into it. I don't think people care whether it's a box or a book when they buy an Amazon. If they want it, they'll buy it. And then I think also board games have changed a lot of the metrics that things like game store owners are running through when they decide to bring in a product. Board games are hugely popular now. And so the idea of doing a RPG product that is packaged a little bit more like a board game in some ways may be advantageous. That may allow you to get into some hobby stores that don't carry traditional book RPGs anymore, for example. And also, I think probably if you're smart about sourcing your stuff and can get it affordably, you can bring in a box that is affordable that you can actually make money on. I hope. We're just doing our first one. That kind of transitions to another thing I've mentioned elsewhere in seminars and things, but I think is really, really important. I feel like when TSR put out their original, red box and the expert set and stuff back then, I think that there have been a number of attempts to kind of recreate that success, and they've met with not quite the same amount of success. Part of it, of course, is because D&D, when those things came out, was riding kind of a Cabbage Patch Kids / Pokemon level of fad, that is just uncontrollable, and you can't really replicate that type of a thing. But I think a problem that a lot of companies, not just TSR, Wizards, but everybody who's done box sets, especially of the introductory variety, I think they start from a pretty mistaken point of view. And that is, we need to price this thing like an impulse item. So if you look at some of the ones that Wizards has done, if you look at some of the ones that TSR did near the end, they were like $10 or $20. So they start with a price point. I think part of that's probably because they want to get it into Target or Walmart or something where they have very strict rules about how expensive stuff can be, or at least strict desires about how expensive stuff can be. And so they start and they say, okay, this box set can cost $10. And then they figure out, what can we put in a $10 box set? And the answer is like 2 16-page booklets with no cover stock, one sheet of counters, and some chits or whatever it is. But it's never what you actually want to get people into the hobby. And so how we started with this is we said, what components do we need to put into the box to accurately introduce the hobby of tabletop gaming to a new person? Well, you're going to need the dice. You're going to need quality components. You're going to need some kind of play surface, like a flip mat. You're going to need counters. And once we figured out what we needed in the box to make a successful product, then we figured out what the product was going to cost. I knew, for example, that I wanted it to come in at $34.99, and we did, I think as a result of us just trimming a little bit of our profit margin to get it there. But really, my main concern was making it cheaper than a video game. If it was cheaper than a video game and cheaper than the core rulebook for the Pathfinder role-playing game, I figured that was good enough. I didn't need to make it some mythical $10 or $20 purchase. I mean, I spent $10 on lunch today, and I know I'll spend $20 on dinner. It's not the same as it was in 1982. So I think a lot of these products in this category have been sort of crippled before they even started by unrealistic approaches to make them cheap. And I think what people don't want is cheap. I think what people want is fun. And it's more important that you have the fun part than you have the cheap part. And frankly, I think $35 for a box set filled with over 100 pages of material and that weighs almost about 5 pounds, I think that's cheap enough.
Oh, yeah. I mean, with moms taking their kids to GameStop on the Saturday to buy a $60 game, I mean, this is, right. I mean, from like a parent child perspective, this is a huge step up.
Right. You know, and the irony, I think, is if you price your products to place it in like a Walmart or a Target, and I know that the Red Box, for example, that they just put out for 4th edition, I've heard it made it into a Walmart. I don't really shop at Walmart, so I didn't see that, but I did see it at Target. I only saw it at Target for about 2 weeks, though, and then it was gone. So predicating your entire strategy on 2 weeks of sales, maybe 2 weeks of sales at Target is worth it. You know, I don't know, because we've never had the guts to put something into Target or the money, but I kind of doubt it, you know, and so we're going with a little bit more of a premium strategy and hoping that it pays off.
Yeah, I've noticed the Redbox stays stocked at Toys R Us. I don't know if it's just nobody's buying it or if they
I don't really have a reason to go to Toys R Us much anymore, but if that's true, I think that's huge. Definitely as the leader in the business, I think Wizards of the Coast, through their ownership at Hasbro, I think they've got a lot of opportunities to get the hobby into places where companies like Paizo or even smaller companies, we wouldn't even have the first hope of getting it into a place like Toys R Us. So if it's still been in Toys R Us consistently, I think that's a huge, huge thing that will benefit the hobby as a whole.
So talking about stores, I want to talk about the Paizo store, because it's as someone who is supporting the OGL, it really only seemed natural for you guys to continue that, to have ways for people to make Pathfinder approved products or whatnot. But it's my understanding you guys also sell other things in the Paizo store, like, for example, Geeky Clean soaps and such. And I'm curious what your intention is for the Paizo store, how you see it fitting into a market alongside things like DriveThruRPG and such, and just where you see it going from here.
Well, I mean, the Paizo store actually predates Pathfinder RPG. We have had a Paizo store almost as long as we've had a Paizo. I think the original infrastructure for the store was built years ago because we used to do Star Wars Insider Magazine, and they had a special anniversary Boba Fett action figure that we had to figure out a way to sell to, you know, all the members of the Star Wars fan club. And so they started creating this store infrastructure. And once that was in place, and once we'd started building a community of people who were coming to Paizo on a regular basis to chat about their games or get advice from one another, we wanted to sell our own stuff. But we said, you know, why stop there? Why not figure out a way to sell all kinds of gaming stuff? Because, you know, none of us are interested in just one game. We're all interested in a lot of different things. And so that's why basically the Paizo store was created. And so subsequently, you know, we now have, I think, over 20,000 items on the Paizo store from pretty much any publisher. If you can get the product from a major game distributor, you can pretty much get it from Paizo.com. And so we've been building that business in parallel to our publishing business for quite some time. It also allows us to do fulfillment on subscriptions of our products, which is a major part of our business and a major thing that keeps us able to create products that can be sold through traditional or brick and mortar sources as well. So it's a pretty significant part of our business, and I would anticipate that it will continue to be so for some time.
Yeah, I was actually surprised. I was out there looking today before we got you on the line, and I saw that Paizo was the publisher for our friends over at Dead Gentlemen, the guys that did Gamers and Gamers Dork.
That's right. Yep, we do. We do work with them, and they now have kind of a new incarnation called Zombie Orpheus, and they've done a thing called Journey Quest, and we're selling that as well as the previous the Gamers DVDs.
Is it bad that I thought you said Zombie Orifice?
You know, you'll have to ask those guys. I don't know if that's bad or if it's intended or what, but that's
we've had Matt Vanslow on the show before, so I can track him down and ask him if you want to know.
I still email him occasionally. I'd have no problem asking him that. I actually really enjoyed Journey Quest, that first season of it.
Journey Quest is really, really funny, and Matt has a lot to do with that. I think he wrote and directed it, and I think it's hilarious. So those guys are definitely – we've been working with them for a long time, and I presume we'll continue to do so as well.
So I just had a thought from the business perspective. When does a company like a role-playing game company make the decision to sell its own product on its website? I mean, because obviously there's huge advantages to that, at least I think so, but – I mean, from what I can tell, you can't actually buy any Wizards of the Coast products from the Wizards of the Coast website.
Yeah, that's true.
What would be the advantage of that?
What would be the advantage of selling your own?
No, of not selling your own stuff on your own.
I mean, you'd have to ask them. I have no idea.
I can actually tell you, as someone who's done mail order sales, it's difficult. You have to put together the infrastructure. You have to be able to pack
it. There's also
you have to. It's a lot of manpower.
Another reason, and I once again, I don't know specifically what WotC's business model is, but when you sell your products, there's a traditional distribution chain. And when you start doing online sales, the local gaming store, the distribution companies, many of these all get cut out of the process, which, depending on their attitude, they may not take too kindly to. Mm-hmm. And so there is some pressure on these companies to not do online sales in order to keep
those.
And that's
true. And we're not immune from that either. I mean, there are some game, you know, store managers and things who are not exactly happy about the fact that we sell our products. And when you look at, for instance, Pathfinder Adventure Path subscription, which you get a discount on, you know, they get even more frustrated by that. My answer to that is, if we didn't do that, we would have no Pathfinder for anyone to sell, because the, you know, the hobby trade in and of itself is not big enough to sustain the kind of publishing operation to produce products of the quality that we want to produce. So, you know, I mean, my answer to that is that our direct sales help to sustain that community of Pathfinder players that makes it possible for them to sell Pathfinder stuff in their stores. Some of them would agree with that logic and some of them certainly wouldn't. And it's an ongoing discussion and it's something that, you know, we work on very hard. You know, there are other ways that we, you know, try to support, you know, hobby stores that sell Pathfinder stuff, like Pathfinder Society program. You know, we've got the Venture Captain program, which are sort of senior volunteers in pretty much all the cities in the country, and we're setting them up with demo programs for stores. We do free RPG day, you know, we do posters and that kind of thing for people to, you know, that we give away to retailers. So that, you know, it's just a piece of the puzzle that we need to do in order to maintain the standards of the products that we know our customers want. Why other companies do it differently, I don't know. I think a company like Wizards probably could handle the fulfillment side, but honestly, you know, as we've been working on the Pathfinder side to figure out a sustainable business model, the part of our company that does the website has been working on, you know, doing that. And though I don't have a lot to do with that side of the business, I am in a lot of meetings where that stuff is discussed. And, you know, anything from last-minute changes to postal code regulations to the weight of a product if you put a promotional brochure into it, bumping it to another shipping class. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of little rules and regulations and corner cases and customer service elements that, you know, I can understand why a company wouldn't want to bite that off. It's a big deal.
I think in the future, we may see less of the companies not doing it. Just from a strict standpoint of, there is a cost-benefit analysis at the moment that every company has to go through as they get larger, where at some point it's not worth it for them to do their own shipping and direct sales. As things start to move more into digital, though, a lot of those costs are based on, as you mentioned, the shipping, the size, the shipping. Once you get into digital, you don't have some of those same costs. You have infrastructure concerns, but you don't have nearly the level of math you have to do to make, you know, shipping a viable sales option.
Eric, as we close this one out, I want to give you the same opportunity we give all of our guests, which is there anything that you guys have going on at Paizo right now or you've got coming up, apart from the beginner box thing, that you'd like to draw people's attention to or get them psyched up for?
Well, I'd love to spend another hour talking about my third grade Dungeons & Dragons class, but you're right, I probably should push some product. You know, the big thing that I've been working on very heavily lately is the Pathfinder Battles pre-painted plastic miniatures from WizKids. They produce that under license from us, and I'm working very, very heavily and very frequently with those guys to kind of set the set lists and approve the sculpts and all that, and that's just been extraordinarily fun for me. And we've been leaking images every Friday on the Paizo blog at paizo.com, and we've probably shown about half the set at this point in time. It's supposed to release in December, the first big set, which is called Heroes and Monsters. But the very first Pathfinder Battles miniatures is a four-pack called Pathfinder Beginner Box Heroes, and they are four of our iconic characters. In fact, the four characters that are provided with the Beginner Box. Those will be coming out on November 9th, and it's like $12.99 for four super high quality pre-painted plastic miniatures. And I think these things are among the best looking pre-painted plastic miniatures I've ever seen. I'm obviously biased, but I've also heard a lot of people with no reason to lie to me tell me that, which is nice. So I'm super psyched about the quality of these miniatures, and I think people will be really, really excited about them when they come out. The first set is Heroes and Monsters, like I said, and that's 40 minis, and that comes out in December from WizKids. And then the next set after that is in June, which is themed after our Rise of the Rune Lords Adventure Path, which is our very first Adventure Path that we ever published for the Pathfinder Adventure Path product. And that is also going to be republished by us under the Pathfinder rules as a hardcover book in the summer of 2012 to celebrate Paizo's 10th anniversary and the 5th anniversary of the Pathfinder Adventure Path. So we will have a 60 miniature set to support that Adventure Path with a lot of the key NPCs and major monsters and things from that Adventure Path. So I would encourage people to check that out as well. We haven't really shown any of the images for that yet, but they are amazing. And I will start revealing those just as soon as Heroes and Monsters comes out in December.
Good. When does the Beginner's Box actually release? I don't think we've heard
Beginner
of
Box,
here.
Beginner Box should be in hobby stores on October 26th, and it should be in bookstores maybe about a week after that. Beginner Box Bash is a big demo program that we're going to be running in stores all around the country, and we'll be announcing dates and locations for that and probably about this next week here. So keep your eye on the Paizo blog for more information about that, but there's probably going to be a Beginner Box Bash event at a store near you.
Awesome, and I will probably try to get some of these links from you to put in the show notes. So, Eric, I want to thank you very much for joining us. It was great talking to you.
Hey, thanks for having me. Maybe we'll do this thing again in 3.5 years.
And Willie, I want to thank you also for joining us for this recording.
Yeah, great job, Willie.
Yeah, thanks. I just wanted to, maybe this will get cut, but Chad, my best friend is, you're like his idol or something, and I just wanted to go down on the mics that I'm talking to you and he's not. He'll get a kick out of that.
This is going to be Chad's new ringtone. So,
maybe. As if he didn't have a big enough head already.
Dude, yeah, Mike, I'm sorry, guys.
We have to deal with him.
Yeah, he has to get custom hats because of his big ass head.
I got a fan, guys.
Yeah. So as for the rest of you guys, thank you for tuning in. Don't forget to check the show notes. We'll put up links to a bunch of the stuff that we talked about there. And also, the Fear the Con site is still live, and so you want to get out there and get signed up for that. The past four have been awesome. You do not want to miss number 5.
Indeed.
And we will catch you guys next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.